This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. For the past several months, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been examining the high rate of African-American male incarceration in the Milwaukee area. We've looked at the impact on both the Black and the broader community, and in the coming weeks, we'll look towards solutions to the issue. We've also discussed some of the myriad causes of the problem, and some have spoken about what they see as racially discriminatory practices at several levels. While some lump that concept in under the umbrella term racism, our first guest this morning would urge you to understand the distinctions between the two concepts. Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies. She was one of Marquette University's three Metcalf chairs this semester and talked about the persistence of racial inequality last week in Milwaukee. She joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
One of the key points, maybe the key point you make in your work, is that despite the fact that racism as maybe an overt act is not as prevalent in this country as it once was, racial discrimination and inequality still persists. What are you getting at? What do you mean by that, and how is it most evident?
Sure. So one of the things that sort of guided the entire project is this reality that on the one hand, we're a country that since the mid-60s has proclaimed a commitment to equality, to egalitarianism. And I do think that that virtue is held sincerely. At the same time, we see not just deep inequality along the lines of race, but also what I call practices of inequality. So I get to that by looking at research in economics and sociology and political science and neuroscience and all of these different fields. And what you see is there are patterns where people disadvantage others on the basis of race. And so the prevalence of these patterns is really extraordinary. And so I tried to puzzle through, how does this happen? How is there such a disjuncture between our stated values and our practices? How do we learn this behavior? And I really come to the conclusion that this is not how we think about, we conventionally think about racism as like animus, right? I don't like this person because of who they are. It's not that so much as it is the ways we're socialized to see other people. This happens through popular narratives about different groups. This happens through the way that we organize society and the kind of categories that we place people into. This happens through the kind of spaces we see people occupying, like kind of geographies, neighborhoods, and the like. And so I wanted to talk about how to understand racial inequality as a cultural practice, and then to think about how do we begin to undo those cultural practices.
Well, what are some of those popular narratives that you talk about that maybe are common, but people who aren't paying attention don't realize that that's what these narratives are about?
Right. So I think that's a great question. I mean, so for example, things like African Americans don't value education or don't want to work or have been so damaged by the history of racism that they are unwilling to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Those, and I think it's important to say, those narratives are not held by members of one political party or another, and not necessarily held by groups of members of a particular racial group. I mean, I think they're sort of when I say it's part of American culture, it's pervasive. So it's not a kind of one-way thing. It's the way – so that you even have people within that group believing those narratives. It's just always not them. It's somebody else, right? who has a – and so I think it's just – it's an indication. And part of why this happens is because, you know, we look at the world around us. We see that different people tend to live in different places, to occupy different locations in our society, and we don't understand why.
I was just going to ask, right? if we're just not asking why.
We're not asking why, and so part of what our brains do is we fill in the gaps to explain what we see. We tell stories, and we repeat stories. So, for example, when I teach my students, when I ask my students, why do you think there's a racial wealth gap, before they have been through a semester of my class, and they often think, well, different rates of savings or different commitments to home ownership and the like. And then when I tell them, well, in fact, in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, the federal government had discriminatory policies that led to differences in home ownership rates and values of homes, right? And so I think that's – now, these are students who are not presuming any inferiority. They just don't know, right? And so part of this, I talk in the book about shifting our narratives, is to tell a fuller story in order to undo the way racial narratives guide our behavior.
Would you contend that the getting past the intentional part of racism was maybe the easy part? Not that it went quickly, but in some ways it seems like shifting that sort of straight ahead, I don't like people because of the color of their skin, is a much easier thing to wrap your head around than this post-intentional racism.
I think it is something that's easier to wrap one's head around, although it places us in this bizarre conundrum. So there was when people saw inequality and racial bigotry was a norm, then it was easy to understand what was going on. When the average American is walking around saying, I don't believe in racial inequality, and trying to make sense of this society that is unequal, and then feeling deeply uncomfortable about talking about race, right? It makes a really difficult kind of, you know, soup of things that we're having to deal with. So this is the harder part, but it's also difficult because there was so much unfinished business after the Civil Rights Revolution. And so it's not entirely surprising that this is where we are at this point.
I wonder if part of the issue is that for many white people, they hear the phrase racial discrimination and they say, well, that can't be because I'm not a racist.
Right. And I think the problem is the label racist forecloses so much conversation, right? And so, and I almost think we live in a moment where there is more anxiety about being labeled a racist than there is about racial inequality. And so when I talk about practices of inequality, I'm not talking about what we mean generally when we say someone is a racist, a feeling of animus. But the reality is that I, as an African-American woman, if I go to purchase a car, I am more likely to pay more. Right. I don't think that the person is looking at me and saying, I want this black person to pay more. But I do think that something is happening about the sense of identification or disidentification with me as a buyer that leads me to have to pay more. Or, you know, it happens in housing or in medical care, you know. So you see doctors much less likely to order more extensive testing for African Americans. Some of that is even related to this idea that African Americans are less likely to be compliant with respect to taking medication. That's true, but the question should be not – the answer is not to deny treatment, but rather to say, well, why are they less likely to be compliant? And so I think, you know, it's – practices of inequality don't require any conscious animus. What they depend upon, though, is ways of seeing people and how we tell stories based upon what we see when we look at someone.
Well, and so let's take those couple of examples, say the practice of inequality in medical care or the practice of inequality in terms of buying a house or a car. How do we start to unpack those and push the needle back towards equality in cases like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many ways to approach this. So one way is to, and this is the way that sometimes people have done this in medicine, is actually create more stringent standards of care, period, right? So that everybody who we see having these set of symptoms has to have these types of outcomes so that there's not the space for the exercise of discretion. It's difficult to say we want to get rid of discretion. On the one hand, discretion helps us work with some kind of nuance. You know, different situations are different, right? Do we want everything so tightly regulated? On the other hand, it's where there is discretion is where we see practices of inequality occurring. They occur across lines of political difference, across lines of ethnic difference. And so one response is to have a sort of a higher level of standards of care. Another kind of response, which is a broader cultural response, is to begin to be more explicit about this evidence, right? One of the things that a lot of social cognition research shows is that when people become aware that certain behaviors are associated with racial inequality, they are more capable of self-correcting. And so if you say, oh, this is the kind of thing where discrimination always happens, then it gives people information that enables them to watch themselves and make sure that they're acting in a fair fashion. And so the bizarre thing is that, you know, because it's so impolite to talk about race in this country, then we don't give ourselves the opportunity to do that.
Well, and it sounds like the conversation you're hoping takes place, or the new narrative, if you will, is one that isn't necessarily accusatory. It's just putting this on people's radar screens.
Exactly. I mean, I think the problem and this is a problem for in terms of what happened in constitutional law. We began to identify racial inequality in terms of individual actions, bad actors. And that's a problem because race is a cultural and social phenomenon. It is not individual. It has, you know, the only way that we can see these patterns is in accumulation. In each individual case, you can probably find a reason for a multitude of potential reasons that any person made a decision, right? So you can't rely upon saying this action was racist, right? What you have to do is create safeguards and ways of reshaping how people talk and think about things that enable – that reduce the accumulation or the patterns as opposed to focusing on the individual actor.
The situation currently exists. We at this radio station actually have spent the last few months looking into the issue of the high rates of African-American male incarceration in Milwaukee County. And I'm curious to get your take on how this dynamic plays into that equation. I mean, the narrative tends to go along the lines of, at one level, there's a group of people that point to the fact that so many African-American males are incarcerated. And then on the other side, you have people saying, well, African-Americans are also disproportionately victims of crimes.
That's right.
And so I guess if you were to take your look at transcending racial inequality in this context, how would you start to unpack that situation, if you will?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I immediately turn to is that at every stage of the process of law enforcement, there's evidence of the practices of inequality. So rates of stop, right, the decision to pursue a case, what the person is going to be charged with. And it doesn't just fall along lines of race where in like circumstances, African-American defendants tend to be treated more harshly, right, from arrest to conviction. But it also has to do with color. So darker-skinned African-Americans are much more likely to be convicted with longer sentences than lighter-skinned African-Americans. So once we know that, right, that to me occasions something that we need to actually sound some alarm bells over, particularly given that the rate of incarceration is so astronomical in the United States and that felony conviction really kind of disables people for the rest of their lives in terms of employment and in terms of being productive members of the society, right? I would add that the rates of incarceration have gone up dramatically. Now they're just starting to dip, but they've gone up dramatically even as crime has been reduced, right? So I would want to I would advocate taking approaches that are actually – that is as opposed to the kind of tough-on-crime law and order response, which has coincided so tightly with practices of racial inequality, to think strategically and carefully about how do we reduce crime, right? And that has a lot to do with employment, right? That has a lot to do with various kinds of social services, as opposed to a response that is carceral, because a carceral response is just in some ways just triggers practices of inequality in ways that are particularly pernicious.
Well, and in this case, would you say more discretion is better?
More discretion is absolutely not better, because the more discretion there is, we found even with both juries and judges, the more discretion there is more discrimination. Now, discretion, on the other hand, though, with respect to not having mandatory sentences is productive, because mandatory sentences have been, you know, have just increased incarceration just exponentially. But we do want to have some pressure to treat like cases in like fashion. And also the incentive structure for prosecutors, right, to pursue more a higher conviction rate is deeply problematic, right? Over 90% of cases never go to trial, right? The plea bargaining system is broken. People don't get their day in court. So there's all these procedural matters that are also fueling this kind of deep inequality and crisis of mass incarceration.
Your book on the subject, More Beautiful and More Terrible, came out 3 years ago, I think, in the midst of President Obama's first term in office. And when Barack Obama was elected, there were all these discussions about whether we are living in the post-racial society. And that almost seems like a quaint storyline in 2014.
Right.
There's plenty of evidence that we are not in a post-racial society. Do you think there's been any progress at all in terms of achieving racial equality? Has the Obama administration to this point or these Obama years had any legacy in terms of moving the needle?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's some sort of modest emotional impact that comes from, you know, it is a big transition to imagine the leader of the United States and what people call the leader of the free world as a person of African descent. That's a dramatic shift. But in terms of the lives of African Americans generally, absolutely not at all. And in point of fact, these have been the years of the greatest economic devastation in the past 40 years. So that the impact of the subprime mortgage lending crisis has basically halved the relative wealth of African Americans, and it's also devastated the wealth of Latinos. And these are years of the incredibly devastating impact of high rates of deportation. And so we have to get beyond the thinking of race in symbolic terms. In fact, in a somewhat prophetic moment, the first title of this book was The First Black President. That was before Obama announced his run. And part of the idea was I was going to say we could have the first black president without shifting anything about racial inequality in this country. That title didn't stick, but I think I anticipated what was going to happen, right? We have these exceptional figures who can transcend everything, and yet people, the large groups, are not necessarily impacted by that.
Well, Imani Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies and faculty associate in Princeton's program in law and public affairs. She was one of Marquette University's three Ralph Metcalf chairs during this semester and spoke last week on the Milwaukee campus. Season 4 of the show Pioneers of Television premieres tomorrow on PBS with an episode on stand-up comedians who went on to successful sitcoms. It's the work of two Milwaukee film producers. We'll chat with Mike Trinkline about the upcoming season when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.